Tonight, we're very pleased to welcome Keith Fox. Now, I know Keith very well. Not only is he a biochemist, which is very important, he's a professor of biochemistry at Southampton, but he was my predecessor of National Chair of Christians in Science. And he's also been director of the Faraday Institute in Cambridge. And if you don't know about the Faraday Institute, there are a few brochures out there, and you can ask Keith about it. It's a really key organisation to link together science and faith, and it's fantastic. Keith studied natural sciences in Cambridge and specialised, as I said, in biochemistry. He then went on to do a PhD in the Department of Pharmacology, and then he moved to Southampton in 1987 as a lecturer in biochemistry and pharmacology, and he became a professor of biochemistry in 2000. His research interests, very relevant tonight, are concerned with the DNA structure, its recognition. And his scientific work has been published in over 200 papers and articles. He was, until very recently, senior executive editor of Nucleic Acid Research. You have stepped down from that now? Just stepped down. He's a former chairman, as I said, and trustee of Christians in Science, and he's editor of our journal in Christians in Science, Science and Christian Belief. And as if that wasn't enough, he's a licensed lay minister in the Church of England. And hot off the press, he's just written a book, which he's got copies there, which he's happy to sell at a reduced price. He'll tell you about that. £16. £16, there you go. Yes, yeah, that's a big discount. And Modifying Genes, Our Genes, Theology, Science, and Playing God. So, without further ado, Keith is going to come and speak to us now. Thank you very much for coming, Keith.
Well, good evening, everybody. Thank you, Andrew, for your warm welcome. It is a particular pleasure to be speaking here because I still have a little bit of a twang. I'm a native-born Bristolian. I lived here for the first 18 years of my life, living in Knowle and Bristol. I know that's the other side of the city, where I won't say any more about that. So it is a particular pleasure to be back here. So we're thinking about the question of personal identity, determinism, genes. I work, as Andrew said, on DNA, and I would like to persuade you it is the most fascinating molecule in the universe. And if it doesn't come across in what I say this evening, speak to me afterwards and I'll have another go. That's me, taken a few years ago. What of me is conditioned by my environment? I'm a Bristolian by birth. And one of it is because of my ancestors. There are six generations of male foxes. My son up on the top left, and my great-great-grandfather on the bottom right. How much can I blame my predecessors for the way that I am? And if you look at that screen, if you follow the way through, you see there is a development. It goes from bow ties to neckties to no ties as you go from bottom to top. Five of those wear glasses as a form of visual enhancement. And they all, bar my son, who was born in Cambridge, all lived in Bristol. In fact, they were builders. If you lived the other side of Bristol, it's quite likely that the bottom three of those may have built the house that you live in. So they've all got that sort of engineering, building, science-type background. Do I inherit that? Does that come in my genes? Is it because I'm a Bristolian? What's my genes? Can I blame any of those for my failings in life? Or is it my fault? Or is it my environment? So James Watson, who was the discoverer of the structure of DNA, famously in 1953, said, "We used to think that our fate was in the stars. Now we know by large measure our fate is in our genes." Well, I can blame my genes, can I? And of course you can get some of these things tested. You can do DNA testing. It's a swab. You're used to doing swabs now for COVID testing. And you send it off and they do some analysis of it. And they tell you your genetic background. They may be able to tell you roughly where you come from. There's a large amount of error in that. They might be able to tell you some things about your physiology. And there are a number of these. Here's a company, 23andMe and Ancestry.com are probably the most familiar of them. I don't, has anybody here actually used any one of those services? Everybody's got one. I guess you're quite unusual in a group of this size not to. People do it for fun, just to find out something about themselves. My advice, I think, is use them very, very carefully. There are stories told of people who have given it to the rest of their family for a Christmas present, and the wife has said, please, please don't do that, don't do it. And the reason, of course, is that there are skeletons in the cupboard that the DNA testing reveals, and there are some things that are best left undiscovered. So be sure how you might use those sorts of things. There's some are more reputable than others. One of my researchers discovered this one, Life Science Pro. It tells you about your superhero profile, your BAM, your Eureka, and your Zoom. It's absolute nonsense. They test for one gene against each one of those. So be careful what you might think you can find out about yourself. How many times have you heard that phrase, it's in their DNA? Here's a collection that my colleague at the Faraday Institute, Dennis Alexander, constructed of things taken from newspapers. So the love cheat gene, the gangster gene, the mean gene, the political behavior gene, cigarettes, it's all in your genes, gluttony in your genes, your political thinking, the liberal gene. In fact, somebody once wrote to the newspaper and suggested there was a geneticism gene. That's for those people who think that their behavior is determined by their genes. It's become a cliche, isn't it? It's in our DNA to do that, to do something. It suggests that our DNA is utterly deterministic of who we are and what we do. If any of you are involved in any public presentations, whether that's in preaching or teaching or corporate activities, please do not use that phrase, because it suggests that it's deterministic. We have no choice. And that's not, we will see, what DNA is about. How much is determinism and how much is free will? So these are some dictionary definitions. The ability to make choices that are not externally determined. The ability of agents to make choices unconstrained by certain factors. And do our genes determine our choices? And should we and can we alter them? Well, it depends what you read. Here is Robert Plomin, who is a renowned geneticist, I think is his background, who says DNA isn't all that matters, but it matters more than everything else put together. Nice parents, he says, have nice children because they're generally nice genetically. Whoa. And he does that based on some genome-wide association studies, as they're calling. And it's taking lots of people together and saying, what's the average on these things? It doesn't actually determine you. It determines, if you like, an average across lots of people with those genes. It works for populations, but it does not work for individuals. And it's probabilistic, not deterministic. So I want to argue that, can I blame my genes? Well, genes may affect our potential. There are clearly some genetic diseases that will restrict what you can do. But we are still responsible for our actions. Even Richard Dawkins says, the arch evolutionist, a good popularizer of science, says that we're the only ones who can escape from our genes. And so we have doctors, social benefits, hospitals, so we can tame and overthrow the tyranny of natural selection, as he puts it. And I rather like this quote from Mark Twain about determinism. You may know the story of Washington couldn't tell a lie. Mark Twain says, I'm different to Washington. I have a higher, grander standard of principle. Washington could not lie. I can lie, but I won't. Right? I choose the way that I will behave. I think it's important we understand, before we get too much in the detail of changing DNA, that it's not a blueprint. That's a phrase that's often used. It's a little bit of an instruction manual. It's used for producing proteins and other factors within the cell, but they work in a complex system together. A gene, a piece of DNA, does nothing by itself. It would just look like a piece of cotton wool if I put a piece of DNA on the podium here. It wouldn't do anything except actually decay over time. Genes only do something in the context of a cell, and the cell it's in only does something in the context of the body that it's in, and the body that it's in actually probably only does something in the context of the society in which that individual lives. So our traits emerge from interactions between the genes that do things and the people that we meet, the things that we eat even. It contains the basic information, but it's combined with other things that facilitate our growth and our development, right through from the fertilization of that single cell to its life in utero, to the way in which the child then develops. So we can be guilty of what I would call a genetic reductionism. We pretend that genes are us, if you like. We almost make a god out of DNA. You can't alter it because, well, it's sacred, isn't it? Ooh, mustn't do that. And it suggests, if you like, that we are nothing more than just the sum of our genes. And it actually subscribes to a form of genetic fatalism. Here is Richard Dawkins, the other side of Richard Dawkins, says, DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is. I could agree with that. But then he goes on, and we dance to its music. It determines what we are. I want to argue against that. Because here's an article published in Science, one of the top scientific magazines. Our genes may limit our abilities, but we're much more than the sum of them. We're in an age of the genome. We know about the sequence of the human genome, but we can still recognize that it takes much more than genes to make a human. It's large amount of the interactions that we have. Nonetheless, there are articles published, and you can't read this one, but it's entitled Friendships, Moderate and Associates Between Dopamine Gene Variants and Political Ideology. And that's published in the Journal of Politics, not in a science journal. Or here's something published in the journal Nature, which is the other top science journal, reviewing some of these things on behavior. And I think this is one of the times when I would severely criticize that journal. For within that article, it says an increasing number of studies suggest that biology can exert a significant influence on political beliefs and behaviors. Genes could exert a pull on attitudes concerning topics such as abortion, immigration, the death penalty, and pacifism. Whoa, really? All of that's genetically determined? And then it says it's difficult to change someone's mind about political issues because their reactions are rooted in their physiology. In other words, don't bother talking to people to try and change their minds because you never do it. Well, we know that that's not the case. We know that you can talk to people and change people's behaviors, especially as Christians, as we know that we explain things about the Christian religion. And actually, if you're totally genetically deterministic, if you believe that your genes control everything about you, it tends to lead to what I might call a very conservative, and that's with a small c, society. If the faults with society are in their genes, then you need to deal with the people, not the society that they live, that they live in. And so you can see how your belief in determinism, one way or the other, affects the way that you think. As I said, our behaviors, our roles as individuals, before we start to drill down to genes, actually a lot of those arise from our relationships together. There's this African proverb that says, a person becomes a person through persons. It's our interactions together. And just as DNA does nothing if it's on the bench by itself, unless it's in the context of a cell, so we need each other. And our identity, for a Christian would say it comes in our relationship with God, who knows about us and gives us significance and purpose, but also our interaction with each other and our life lived together. But let's drill down to some individual genes at the moment and start to think about, if you like, genetic diseases. Life isn't fair, is it? I am never going to be a brilliant runner. I go running quite frequently and I'm mediocre. I have the wrong muscle type in order to be a sprinter. That's the fault of my genes. My eyesight is the way it is. That's genetic. My hair is this color. I certainly can blame my ancestors on that as one who went prematurely gray at the age of 30. It's not fair, is it? Some people are musically gifted, some are academically gifted. Life isn't fair. Maybe we should level the playing field. Maybe we should enhance people's genes or swap them around to give them the best combination so as everything then becomes fair. And that means not actually introducing new genes. It's just taking the best of genes from each individual and putting them together in the right combination to give you the best chance in life. We'll explore that as we go through. But there are genetic disorders, some of them tragic and life-changing or life-threatening. There's between, say, 4,000 and 5,000 diagnosed genetic disorders, and about 1 in 25 children in one way or other is affected by them. Some have fairly minor effects on their lifestyle. Some are tragically life-transforming. And some are obvious from birth, and others don't appear until much later in development. Can we do anything about these? Here's some examples and things from cystic fibrosis to hemophilia, Huntington's disease, Tay-Sachs disease, Down syndrome. The human genome is about 3 billion bases long. The base is this A, G, C, and T, that repeating alphabet of letters, and that's that precise order that makes you, you, and me slightly different, because roughly one in every thousand of those in my genome is different to yours, which is one in every thousand different from the person next to you. And a change in maybe only one of those can have devastating consequences. Here's an example on the screen of the a single change. The top line is hemoglobin, and the line underneath is one change from a T to an A that switches that to a form of hemoglobin that gives sickle cell disease, which particularly in Africa is prevalent in some populations. And again, a debilitating disease. One change in 3 billion. So wouldn't it be nice to be able to take that and correct it? If you like a cut and paste that you used to in your word processing programs, to be able to say, I don't like that piece of DNA, let's take it out and replace it with something else. And until really, I'd say 10 years ago, that was a bit of a scientific dream. And within the last 10 years, in fact, particularly within the last 6 years, there have been great developments on that. And they take some fancy names. Talens or ZFNs, or I suppose we should call them ZFNs because it was the Americans that discovered, that developed them. And more recently, this thing called CRISPR-Cas9. I know that CRISPR sounds like a cooking oil, but it's not. It's a very profound technology for being able to precisely change the sequence in a genome. And actually, CRISPR is a technique now that is widely used in molecular biology labs for understanding fundamental principles of the ways in which cells and organisms work. And it's a remarkable one. Here's a book written by John Parrington, who's an Oxford academic. And he points out that every once in a while a scientific discovery is made whose impact on society is likely to be immense, such that an abundance of superlatives may not do it full justice. Genome editing looks like it's going to be such a discovery. And the two inventors or discoverers of that were awarded the Nobel Prize last year for that discovery. And there have been some remarkable things that have come from it. Here's an example of a child who was in the terminal stages of a cancer. All the chemotherapy had failed and went through a genome editing technique, a particular one where cells were taken from her body, modified, and then put back again. That's a very quick way of describing what was done. And she went into remission. A remarkable thing. I don't think anybody would want to criticize that. It saved a life. But that's at the level of doing things on the whole person, where it only affects that one individual, and usually they have choice in that treatment. There's some form of autonomy within that. That is treating the whole person, the developed individual, for what we have. We possess what are called somatic cells. That's cells from the body. They're ones that are fully developed. And our bodies contain probably of the order of a 10 trillion, somewhere about 10 trillion cells. We can debate an order of magnitude on that. A trillion is 1,000 billion, and a billion is 1,000 million. So we're talking lots. So correcting something in that many cells is nigh on impossible. You've got to have a system whereby you can eradicate, say, certain blood cells, or where converting only a small number has a great effect. That's, if you like, the body cells. That's a very, very inefficient process. Far more efficient would be to change things at the early embryo stage, and that's what I want to spend some time discussing, to take that single cell, which all of us originated from originally, that egg and the sperm that are combined together to form that very early embryo, one, two, four, maybe eight cells, and to change them in that. Then, of course, you change everything that develops from that, all the trillions of cells that will develop. And more importantly, in every generation afterwards will inherit it. Something done on the whole body, of course, is not passed on to the next generation. Something done on an embryo will be. Now, your attitude to that will in part be coloured by what you make of the human embryo. If the human embryo is, you think, a person, and we should not do anything with that, then actually the vast majority of what I'm going to say now, you will say, well, that's irrelevant. And I will respect that view. We might talk about it afterwards. I'm going to assume that at least at that very early stage that we can do things with that, but it's should we? Should we do experiments on early embryos? And the first articles started to appear, where is that? It's about 2015, of doing things in cell, single cells, not in any intention of implanting that so as it would lead to any development. In fact, it was done on embryos that could not develop. They're called they came from two sperm and one egg, so it was totally unviable. Tripronuclear, that's the word I was looking for, which is on the screen anyway, so I should have seen it. And then other experiments done, again, on cell lines to show that you could change the gene that causes some inherited forms of deafness, and showing that could be done on human cells and it could be done on mice. We could do other things there that, at least in cell culture, deal with some of the more common genetic defects. Those who have a defect in one of the genes controlling their heart, that you'll have seen the things in the newspapers where people drop dead, having been apparently healthy, but because they've got that genetic mutation, and it can be corrected at the early embryo. And then the shock, of course, was in late 2018, so 3 years ago, almost to the day, this Chinese scientist announced that he had modified human embryos and implanted them, and that two twins had been born. I have to say that we're still on his word. I think he's telling the truth. That's never been published in any of the scientific literature, because, of course, he was hauled over the coals for what he said for that, because he had broken just about every ethical rule, and they have plenty of those in China as well as in is in Europe. And he'd done something that was totally unnecessary. He'd actually made the small mutations so that they become resistant to infection by HIV. There are plenty of other ways of making sure you don't get infected by HIV. And he is now in jail. But why is it a problem? It was widely denounced by the scientific community as well as wider society. Well, firstly, it was not done for any therapeutic principle. What are the risks involved in that? Every time you try and edit one thing, there's a risk that you actually have what's called off-target effects. Do you modify something else in the genome by accident that is a little bit closely related to it? Actually, in that case, there was no informed consent. Some people say we're playing at God. Could it be used for enhancement to make different kinds of people? It's verging on eugenics, and we'll touch on that. So making the kind of people that we want, and that means actually disposing of the people that we don't want, who want to take it to extremes. And we're making commodities out of people rather than personalities. So what should we do? What are the risks? What about consent? What about the attitudes that we might have for those who have not been corrected, for those who carry that genetic mutation? Are we saying to them, I wish you weren't here? One is normal. There's only one normal person in this room, as far as I'm concerned, and he's speaking to you at the moment. And I assume that you also think that you're probably pretty normal. Are we on the slippery slope to changing what human physiology means? And is there actually a difference between therapy and enhancement? And some of the things I'll talk about are actually a little bit like science fiction. There are things that we dream that we might be able to do in the future. And I'm unashamed about discussing things in that way. Too often, we're guilty of playing catch-up. Things happen, and we then think after, well, should that have happened? No, let's think in advance, when this is just science fiction, because today's science fiction quickly becomes tomorrow's science fact. Let's think about the what-ifs. Our attitudes depend on what we think about health and disease. It depends on what we think makes a fulfilled life. About the shame, is there any shame in being dependent on other people? What do we think about people who suffer from any form of disability? For those who don't match our own social norms as to what we think normal should be. And actually, what do we value in other people? Firstly, though, is it necessary? And the answer is probably in most cases, no, for these genetic diseases. Because we have pre-implantation genetic testing. You can take that 8-cell embryo, which would be generated for in vitro fertilization. You can take one of those cells out without harming the embryo at all and look at its genome and see, does it have the genetic defect? And if it doesn't, well, that's healthy. You can implant it. And if it does, then you choose not to. There are very few genetic diseases for which this sort of technology would be necessary that couldn't be addressed by testing on the embryos first. There are a few. There are some where there just aren't enough healthy embryos to be able to pick a good one rather than one that contains a defective gene. And also some conditions arise not just from one gene, but from multiple genes interacting together. You may get a lot of what we might call bad genes. Francis Collins, who is a lovely Christian and director of the National Institutes of Health in the USA, he was the director of the Human Genome Project when the human genome was fully sequenced. He, I think, stands down as director of the NIH at the end of this calendar year. And he, speaking in his role in that position, talks about the strong arguments engaging in this activity remain. These include the serious and unquantifiable safety issues, ethical issues presented by altering the genome in a way that affects the next generation without their consent, and a current lack of compelling medical applications. So, should we? But if we could, is it just a form of embryo healing? I mean, for the Christian, healing and restoration and feeding of the poor and looking after the underprivileged are part of the Christian's duties. We're used to organ transplants, aren't we? Heart transplants, liver, kidney, whatever that might be. Is this just a DNA transplant? Well, actually, I don't think it is, for the reasons we started with, is that this affects not just the individual. It goes on to the next generation and subsequent generations afterwards. Is it playing at God? Well, I think we need to be careful about using that phrase. Firstly, I don't think most of the scientists that I know are not playing. They're deadly serious in their research. And it's an insult sometimes to describe them as playing. Could this technology be part of the God-given armory of things that we have? To help us alleviate disease. We have antibiotics, we have surgery, we have all sorts of things. Is this another one that adds to that? Be careful about condemning something too quickly. What did Jesus say, questioning the Pharisees? Is it lawful to do good or to do harm when they were fixated on the Sabbath rules? But on the other side of it too is we shouldn't welcome disease in some sort of fatalism as though everything is God's will. After all, we do what we can to correct other forms of disease. So I'm putting that in just maybe to temper things the other way. Where would we stop if we could do it? Should we modify the genome of an embryo that will otherwise die of a genetic disease? I think a lot of people would say yes to that. It's giving life where there was no life. What about modifying the embryo that will have, say, something like cystic fibrosis? An unpleasant condition, one that is life-limiting. All right, the life expectancy of people with that is increasing, but it's still life-limiting. Should we modify the genome of an embryo that would develop something much later in life? Huntington's disease is an awful disease. I had a colleague who died from it. But it doesn't develop until people are in their 30s or 40s. They live apparently healthy lives up till then. What if the embryos seem to have that? Should we modify that? And going to the other extreme, the cosmetic one, should we modify embryos to change hair colour or eye colour or some other, if you like, incidental? But we also need to think about the fact that there are limitations about what genome editing can achieve. Because genes, as I said, don't determine everything about us. They may limit what we can do. They may affect some of our physical development. But do they affect everything about our personalities? Lots of things about us are the consequences of many genes interacting together to give an effect. Not one gene. So there's not one gene for height. There's not one gene for intelligence. In fact, for IQ, intelligence, there is a genetic component to it. But the literature says there's probably 74 at least genetic markers which contribute between them about 0.4% to IQ in its genetics. You'd actually do far better to increase the quality of education to improve that rather than do genetic modification, because it's so many genes interacting together. And even something like type 2 diabetes, which I think Andrew will probably know more about than I do. There are many, many genes that interact together to do that, located at many points on the genome. We're complex beings. What about modifying genomes to make people better? Right? Here's something, a piece in the literature called the Genetic Virtue Project. Actually, this was published before the current ability to modify genomes. And I've put italics on this. The italics are mine to show how much exaggerated it is. Improving morality by genetic engineering. Nearly all personality traits, they say, show moderate, and that's my italics, heritability. Since genes influence enduring behaviours, it might be possible to use biotechnology in a manner that would promote virtue and thus serve as a means to improve ourselves morally speaking. Do you want to be dictated to by your genes as to what ethical and moral principles? Or do you want to decide, I'm going to be good today. I'm going to be a virtuous person. Tom Shakespeare, who is an advocate for the disabled and a remarkable person who suffers from a genetic condition himself and lives a very fulfilled life, says actually people with disabilities aren't crying out for genetic modification. They're crying out against discrimination against them. And the voices of those living with illness and impairment must be heard. Nothing about us without us, as he says. How do we, as a society, include those people whose impairments will not or cannot be edited away? And we're actually becoming, we're in danger of becoming what we might be calling an ableist society, where we favour those with certain physical abilities and we disfavour and, if you like, put to one side those who are dependent and weak and vulnerable. And it comes close to the whole question of eugenics. It has a very long history, does eugenics. This is pre-Christian times. This is in the 5th century BC. The Roman law, the 12, said a father shall immediately put to death a son who is a monster, who has a form different from that of the human race. We don't like it. It's going to be difficult. Infanticide. In fact, the practice of infanticide against those that were, if you like, disabled persisted in the Roman Empire until the onset of Christianity. That made the big change against just disposing of the child because you didn't want it. The appreciation of human life as having intrinsic value, no matter what its physical disabilities might be. But the word became popular in the 19th century, the late 19th century, Francis Galton in particular. He was concerned to maintain the, if you like, the breeding stock of the human species. He said, actually, the stupid people reproduce faster, so we generate more stupid people, and the intelligent people breed with the stupid people, so we generate more stupid people. So those are me parodying what he says rather than anything that I would say. And he talks about a creature not energetic enough to maintain itself must die. That's what Herbert Spencer said. And he claimed that indiscriminate health care would be harmful to society by allowing the weak to survive and reproduce. Awful sorts of things to say, but that was based on some wrong 19th century science. And this sort of idea was still there in the US well into the 20th century. Here's a cartoon, actually. It was there in some American fairs in the 19th century. And I can't actually read the details of it, but it basically says along the lines, you be very careful about how you breed your livestock. You don't leave it to chance as to what cattle and pigs, etc., you get. But it's all random when it comes to people. Right? So we should make sure that we improve the human stock by selecting the right people to breed with. And that led to forced sterilizations of those that they claimed were the feeble-minded, the mentally insane, the drunkards even, which were seen to be maybe genetic dictating each of those. So characteristics such as pauperism, feeble-mindedness. One of the judges dictating whether a girl should be sterilized or not looked back over her ancestors and said, three generations of imbeciles is enough. Awful. But are we beginning to say the same sort of thing if we go too far down the line of saying we should edit humans because they don't happen to match up with our social norms? And we're in danger of sidelining people because they don't fit our preconceived ideas of what a person should be within society. You may think that Nazism was just against the Jews. It was awful, the Holocaust. But the Nazis also euthanized those who were disabled as well because they were an affront to their form of society, those who didn't match their social norms. It's a kind of social engineering by genetics. Here's a rather moving story that appeared in the journal Nature, of a girl called Ruthie who has an inherited condition that means she has very limited eyesight. It's related to albinism. And they interviewed her father and said, before she was born, if you'd had known she was going to be limited eyesight, would you have had her genetically modified if it was able? And he said, of course I would. But he said, now knowing the daughter that you've got, would you choose to have her genetically modified? And he said, certainly not. And actually then they interviewed the child, Ruthie, who is able to play basketball, even with her limited sight. The resilience she had is tremendous. And she's asked, so do you wish your parents had genetically modified you before you were born? And the answer is no. You see, for what seems for some people a disability, for others is a strength. What about deafness? If you're part of the deaf society that uses sign language all the time, that's not a disability. It's just a different culture. There was a case a few years back of a couple who were genetically deaf asking could they have a selection of an embryo to be implanted who would also be genetically deaf because they wanted the child to be part of the same culture that they are. I wonder what you would say to that. The law actually said no. The law said you can only select embryos for positive effects, not for negative ones. But we do know that what for some people is a weakness, for others is a strength. The Apostle Paul talked about the thorn in his flesh, and talked about God's power being made perfect in weakness. You see, human life is a gift to us, not an achievement or an accomplishment. You take what you get and you make the most of it. What about enhancements, making us, if you like, altogether different kinds of beings? Is there a difference between an enhancement and a therapy? Well, no, there isn't a clear boundary between them. I wear these things as optical crutches. They're my form of enhancement. And you might take nutritional enhancements. You might take pharmaceutical enhancements. There's not a clear boundary between what's an enhancement and what is not. But we could possibly think about enhancing people. As I said right at the beginning, not necessarily introducing new genes, but shuffling the pack so that you get the best combination of genes. A science fiction book that I think is great fun, it has of no religious connotations to it at all, is Peter James' book, Perfect People. Never be careful what you wish for. I won't spoil the plot line that for you, but it shocked me when I got to the last chapter. I was not ready for it, and I should have been. Parents who wish things for their children. Maybe they could upgrade their children so that they'd be musically gifted. They'd be athletically the greatest. Giving them the best opportunity. What parent doesn't wish for their child to have the best in life? No, to have good vision, good intelligence, athletic, musical ability, beauty, whatever that means. Are we on the slippery slope? What about athletics? Here's a thing that was published in a newspaper that I don't usually credit much in terms of truth. About the possibility of testing your football team to see whether they had the genes that meant they were prone to injury. And I thought, no, that's a bit of scientific, of journalistic hype. Until I read the scientific literature that says that actually the business of collagen and what form you've got does actually affect how prone you are to injury. So maybe we could change those genes so that the parent could, their child would be brilliantly athletic and not be on the injury bench all the time. Or maybe the football manager could test somebody and say, no, I'm not paying millions of pounds for you because I know from your genes that you're going to be on the substitute bench. What about if you could do that to your children? Would it change the nature of the parent-child relationship? Would it make children into commodities for us rather than something that's a gift that arises, that is just a given to us and we grow, we love them because of who they are rather than what we predetermined they should be? What about if you knew that your parents had modified you? What would you say? You did that to me? Can you leave me alone? Just let me be myself. Imagine the stroppy teenager's response to finding that out. Is there a difference between making and begetting? And we say in the creeds, begotten, not made. And aren't we in danger of making humans rather than begetting them? That technology that might allow us to dictate some of the characteristics of a child. You could also get the form of genetic one-upmanship. I'm going to have my child better than your child. In the same way, you might have one-upmanship with my car is faster than your car. It's greener than your car, or whatever it might be. So we enhance to life 2.0. But the trouble is, as you know from computers, life 2.0 quickly becomes obsolete when life 3.0 arises. So should you choose to have a child now or wait until it could be you get a better version in the future? Today's enhanced child becomes yesterday's child in only a matter of years. You see, it's not such a big leap from saying to somebody you can have a genetically modified child to saying you must have a genetically modified child. Because if you don't have that modification, A, the child will be at a disadvantage in life, and B, Well, they might have a medical condition that means they're going to be a drain on society's resources for the rest of their life. You owe a duty to society to have them modified. It's only a short step between a you can and you must. And here's a philosopher speaking, and I hope I can read my own script on this, because I think this hits home. Renegade scientists and totalitarian loonies, he said, are not the folks most likely to abuse genetic engineering. You and I are, not because we're bad, but because we want to do good. Parents understandably want to give their kids every advantage. The most likely way for eugenics to enter into our lives is through the front door as nervous parents, awash in advertising and marketing and hype, struggle to ensure that their little bundle of joy is not left behind. Do you see the danger in some of this? But there are some people who say, I wouldn't write this off. This is something that God has given us, the technology. Science, after all, is a gift from God to humankind. And think of what's been achieved by that. As we find out the way in which the world works and we do things for the benefit of each other. Is this just one of God's gifts to us? However, it runs the risk if we have the genetically modified, and let's be honest, that will only be possible for the socially rich. It's not going to be a cheap technology. We run the risk of that it's a separate species almost becoming. Those who are genetically pure as compared to the rest of us who are mere mortals. We also run the risk, I think, of saying that faster, brighter, and stronger means better. I don't think it necessarily does. Here's a quote written in the British Medical Journal. Many researchers think that high IQ goes hand in hand with high moral values. This correlation is absolute nonsense. Right? They do not correlate. And we run the risk of instead of making better people, we've just made enhanced humans. And I hope that we would be looking for better people. C.S. Lewis, writing in The Abolition of Man, maybe foresaw those sorts of questions when he said, man's power over nature turns out to be a power exercised by some men, sorry, that means people, over other men with nature as its instrument. We're using the technology in order to control each other. So what does the Christian respond to this? And I'm coming into land within this. And he said, well, we're made in the image of God. But what does that mean in terms of our genome? We know that our genomes are 98% similar to that of a chimpanzee. Does that mean a chimpanzee is 98% made in the image of God? No, certainly not. The genome is not sacred. Somebody say you shouldn't modify the genome because it's sacred. There is no such thing as the human genome. Your genome is different from the next person of lots and lots of places. So what does make us human? Part of it is talking about being God's co-creators. You know, we look after the creation that we're given. And is this a way for looking after it? And the Genesis account talks about us giving a purpose and meaning. But it also says that all humans are made in the image of God. It's not just something that was given to the king, as it would have been in the ancient Near East. It's all human beings are given that divine mandate, that divine responsibility. And each one has that irrespective of their physical abilities. So we are made in God's image, although we are not God. And I think that's the temptation to try sometimes to become as if we're gods. Because to be made in God's image concerns the whole person. And genetic variation and environmental influences and personal choice are part of human development. And it's the whole person who responds as being the image of God. And genetic variation is just another indicator of our human uniqueness. You see, we all have worth and dignity regardless of what you can do. There is no shame in being dependent. as I'm trying to tell my father, who is totally blind, age 90, is that when I was tiny, he looked after me. I was totally dependent. He changed my nappy. And now he's in a state where he has to be looked after because he's unable to look after himself. And there is no shame in that. We're in a society that says, stand on your own two feet. Don't be dependent on everybody. And probably from the mid-teenage years to our late 70s, for most of us, we're able to do that. But we all come into this world utterly dependent. And we will all go out of this world utterly dependent on somebody else. There is no shame in disability and being dependent on other people. So maybe we should look upon the image of God, that Imago Dei, as being an act of God's grace, something that he gives to humankind and gives us responsibility within that at the same time. I'm going to close with a couple of extra quotes contrasting each other. One who says, prediction, he says, my grandchildren will be embryo and screened, germline edited, and it won't change what it means to be human. That's one way of looking at things. The other one is, and I think this is a philosopher speaking, that I would say that she says it maybe it will be done because of people's fear of disability. It'd be done because it might actually, in some cases, save money in order to do it. But then she goes on to say, actually, she wouldn't choose to have it done herself. And then reveals that she suffers from cystic fibrosis and that her choice is to retain the cystic fibrosis. She says there are some benefits in that condition. I have no idea what those can possibly be, and I wouldn't want to be in her shoes. And I then want to go back to, if you like, the one of the words from the psalmist, who says, You created me in my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Gosh, we know a lot more about the physiology and the cell biology and the developmental biology than the ancient Hebrews ever knew about those sorts of things. He said, I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. All of us are, irrespective of whether we have any genetic defects. Your works are wonderful. I know them full well. My frame was hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. And with that psalmist's quote, I'm going to finish talking to you. I recommend a few bits of reading. I think free on the table are Genes and Embryos. And I don't know if Human Enhancement is on the table. It is. Andrew says it is. Those are quite useful. And of course, I recommend my own book. They're published, I'm a scientist, published and edited jointly with a philosopher, Alexander Massman, Modifying Our Genes. It's £25 list price. I'm selling it for £16. And we might haggle together at the back as to how best to pay me. So I hope I've at least raised some questions for you, even if I haven't given you any answers this evening. And I thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Keith. There's a lot to think about there. Just while Tina's got the roving mic, you've got questions, put your hand up and she'll come to you. Could I just ask you one question that you didn't touch on epigenetics? And I just wonder whether, because of course we do actually change our genome during our life, depending on environment, whether that's got any implications?
Yes, it does. I mean, our genomes, our DNA sequence is fixed, apart from mutations that may arise that give cancers, maybe. But epigenetics is the way in which genes can be switched on or off by putting tags onto them. And the ways in which those tags are put on can be influenced by a lot of things. From in utero, what happens in the womb, to be honest, to the things that you eat, the stresses that you're under, the things that you do affect your epigenetic profile. And actually, you could, in theory, use genome editing for changing the epigenetic profile as well. That where our bodies are, say, plastic is the way that some people describe it, malleable, adaptable. there are changes that occur in ourselves by virtue of the lives that we live. We're not fixed at birth with a program that says, well, this is what will inevitably happen to you as you go through life. The things that happen around us influence that epigenetic marker. Does that answer the...
Yeah, and I think I'm right in saying that some of those are actually carried through into the next generation. There are one or two.
Some of them do carry to one generation. I think the literature is not clear as to whether it goes to the second or the third. There is the Dutch Hunger Winter study that suggests that it might go to the second generation, which actually, those will say maybe that's the biblical principle of the sins of the fathers being visited on the children of the third and fourth generation. There is no doubt that those epigenetic things fade out through subsequent generations. Whether they really are propagated to the second and the third, I think the jury is out. But undoubtedly to the next one.
Other questions? One at the front here, then a couple at the back there, whichever, wherever you... One girl there on the right.
Thank you. So for many years, animals, for example, the meat that we eat, it comes from livestock that have been over the years filtered down by farmers, and our pets that we have at home, like cats and dogs, they have been genetically bred to reach certain types of animals that humans like. Would you say that this counts as a genetic modification, and what are the morals around that, and what do you think about that?
Thank you for that. That's a really complicated question. That actually, over millennia, we have been selecting animals with certain properties, not just animals, plants, etc. The sorts of... I could show you slides, but I don't have them with me. The original form of what we now call corn on the cob would have looked particularly unappetizing thousands of years ago. We select and produce by natural means things that are more beneficial to us. We've also selected by chemical means. If I told you that a large number of the crops that we grow commercially now were actually generated probably in the 1940s and 50s by taking seeds and irradiating them with radioactivity or treating them with carcinogens to mutate them and then selecting which ones of those happen to grow the best. I think that shocks some people when you hear that, but I could show you the literature that says that was what was done. Which would I rather, that I was having something that was genetically modified precisely in the way that genetic modification can do now, or something that was modified randomly just by treating it with noxious chemicals? So that's one answer to your question. The other one is then this, could this technology itself be used in producing organisms that have higher meat yields? And yes, it can. And we have to be very, very careful about animal welfare when we do that. Of generating species that actually are almost non-viable. You know, they generate large quantities of meat, but they can't stand up. They're growing. So we do have to have animal welfare in mind. And if you take that through to humans as well, what are the downsides of enhancing certain things? There's usually an up and a downside to it as well. What if we try to enhance intelligence? What might be the knock-on effects? Because we know that genes don't work in isolation. They're multiple, interconnected pathways. When I was a student, we used to have these biochemical pathways that were on the wall. Andrew will remember them as well. And you don't use those now at all because they're just too complicated. It's a multidimensional network of genes interacting together. And rather like pulling a net, as you twang at one end of it, so it has repercussions at the other end as well. So we do have to be very careful about what might be the unintended consequences of doing something that we think is good. That's not to say we shouldn't do it, but we do need to think through the consequences. And certainly there are examples of animals that have been genetically modified for our benefit, and sometimes for their benefit as well. But in the same way as traditional breeding, you'll be aware of breeds of dogs that have difficulty breathing because we happen to like that particular shape of dogs. So we've done harm by traditional methods in the same way as we could do by modern methods. It's the outcome, I think, that's important, not the method that's used to generate it. That's a really deep and good question. Thank you.
There are a couple of questions at the back there.
We've thought quite a lot this evening about the scientific aspects and the social aspects of changing genomes. Could we just think a little bit about the political aspects? Do you think that the politicians in this country and worldwide are ready for this? And what should they do and what might they do? You mentioned about the scientist in China who landed in prison for creating a child that was modified. Where do you think we're going to go forwards in terms of conflict potentially between politicians and scientists?
Thank you. I mean, I'm not sure there's a conflict. At the moment, I think there is unanimity that this should not be done. And all the ethical bodies, whether it's the Nuffield Council in this country or the National Academy of Sciences in the USA or the research councils here, all say it should not be done on human embryos that could be implanted. A total moratorium. And I think that's pretty much the case across the globe. But there is an element to that to which the major question being asked is that of risk, is we don't know what the unintended consequences can be. And I don't think, from what I've said this evening, I hope you'll understand that, I don't think risk is the only principle. They go by the precautionary principle for the moment, which says, if in doubt, don't. But you cannot live with a precautionary principle forever. There has to be a point in time at which you say yes or no. And that may be influenced by your political, your sociological, your economic leanings. I wouldn't like to predict which way it would go and whether it will even follow along party political lines. You could make good cases either way at either ends of the political spectrum. I think some of it, I'm sad to say, and it came out in articles published in the papers only earlier this week, is that most of our civil servants, most of our politicians, just do not understand the science. You know, they've got degrees in greats or PPE from Oxford. I'll name Oxford because I came from the other place. And they do not have a scientific training. That's not to say they're bad people. It's that how can they make decisions that are based on the science if they don't understand it? And that's why I would say we need scientists who are going into politics, at least to be able to understand the underpinning science. It doesn't necessarily underpin the ethics and the morality of doing it, but at least they understand the science rather than, if you like, the glib populist stories that come about, you know, curing this disease, curing that disease, that look very popular, but the scientists will understand the risks involved in that and the consequences. So I am not at all concerned when one of my bright scientist students says, I want to become a teacher, I want to become a policeman, I want to go into the civil service, whatever it might be, because I think, yes, we need scientists in lots of those professions as well, please God.
Just for the next question, I'd like to add to that that one of the things Christians in Science is keen to do is to see eminent Christian scientists in positions of responsibility in ethics committees and so on, because we need Christians who understand the science to influence some of these things in the future. And if we don't support our Christian scientists and help them to get into those positions, we're not doing ourselves a service. So do support Christians in Science. And another question at the back there.
I'll add a rider to that one as well. I criticise politicians for not understanding the science. Church leaders also don't. And that's not a criticism of church leaders, is that generally they don't come from scientific backgrounds, which is why some of things like Christians in Science and other organisations are there to try and help those Christian leaders who have very different skills to at least understand the basics of what science is about.
Yeah, thanks. As a result of the COVID pandemic, we've we're relying quite a lot on the new technology, which is mRNA vaccines. I don't fully understand how that how they work, but is that in some way modifying our genes? And are there dangers in that kind of technology? And there are people who would argue that they are modifying and they are playing with our genes. And how should we answer those people?
Well, the basic science is they don't modify our genes. It's a piece of messenger RNA that gets into the cells that is translated into a protein. It in no way gets into our genes. It would have to become DNA for a start before it could get into our genomes. We have no mechanisms within our cells for taking RNA to DNA. So it won't be incorporated in our genomes. It has no effect on our own genetic makeup. So I think the science in that, I can't say more than that. The science is clear. I think there's quite a bit of fake news out there. And I understand the people who don't understand the science. Some of their reactions can be alarmist. That's human nature. I don't understand it, so I'll criticise it. But there is no evidence that the Pfizer vaccine is the one that has that the mRNA, that would get incorporated into anybody's genome. Thank you. So it's a relevant question.
Was there just one there, I think? That hands up. Tina, up here in the middle.
Where?
The row there.
Ah.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you for the talk and the timely issue, which I think is definitely getting more and more important as the years go by. One of the things that I've read quite a little bit about and also in the scientific literature is that if you go to particularly Denmark as a particular example, then we can already test for particularly Down syndrome when women are pregnant, and above 95% of people who are diagnosed with that end up with an abortion. And the percentage of people who go into that and think they will is considerably lower. So in this sense, we already do embryo selection through these kinds of methods. You can expand to that with IVF. So is then the main concern with CRISPR that we can really target and homogeneously target DNAs? And is that kind of the critical element of CRISPR, which makes it morally so dangerous, that you can homogenize and take away this random element that has always been there through any other method?
Yeah, thank you. I think that's a really interesting point to raise. I think it is, I think CRISPR is slightly different from the Downs thing. I'll talk about Downs in a minute, because CRISPR is pre-implantation. The Downs testing is something that is done post-conception, and it is actually abortion. Whereas we're not talking of abortion in this case, that the embryo has not been implanted. But nonetheless, you're quite right. In some countries, in fact, I think, you better not quote me on it, but I think in Iceland, that Down syndrome has effectively been eradicated. Not by virtue of any genetic changes, but because of the ease with which the testing is done, the number of people that the tests are done on it, and the reaction when somebody tells the expectant mother, what's their words? It's, I'm really sorry to tell you. And that is a loaded diagnosis. To say, I brought you the news, that is very different from telling, I've come to tell you some bad news. And that the implication, the way in which it's told to the parent, really does say, well, you don't want this child, do you? Whereas I have perfectly healthy children, adults now, and I hesitate to speak for those who have Down's children. But for all that I read about them, they say that they have real personalities. They're a gift to society. They're different from you and me, maybe in some respects. They have things that you and I don't have, and that they may have limitations in terms of their life expectancy, in terms of things they can do in life, but they're still real people. So I think the testing, I can see the benefits into it. I think there is some benefit in an expectant mother knowing that the child that will be born will be this way, that way, or the other way. But I think it is really dangerous when we imply that because somebody's different, that they necessarily should be aborted. And I think that is tragic. But you can extend that a little bit further in both ways. There was a study that was, I think, published a year ago where parents could opt to have their newborn child tested across a whole screen of diseases, so whole genome sequencing, I think it was. And it turns out when you do that, that a very high proportion of children have one genetic defect or another hidden somewhere in their genes. And the reports on that said actually they had trouble enlisting people onto that study because no parent who's just been presented with their new bundle of joy, and I became a grandparent not that long ago, no parent would want to think that that bundle of joy was in some way less than perfect. So the other side of it is, well, people actually don't want to know. And there is, my John Wyatt, if you've ever heard John Wyatt speak, yeah. Will talk, and he's a pediatric consultant, or was, now he deals with bioethics, who deals with young babies, will talk very movingly about dependency. And about the ways in which we've changed now from the child was born and presented to the parents and you love them because of who they were, because they were your child. That gift from God, if you want to put it that way. And that they love them because of who they were, because they were their child. And now we're beginning to move away from that. We know things about the child before it's born. And more often than not now, they know whether it'll be a boy or a girl before it's born. Yeah, that helps them to plan. What colour should they put the baby's bedroom? But there are other tests that could be done as well that in some ways are good because they prepare the parents for what might be coming. But in other ways, it actually says you know too much of the child about the child. You have too many expectations of the child before it's born. If we did too many of these enhancements of embryos to give them these qualities, there's a false expectation of what the child will be. You love it because it's going to be a musician. You love it because it's going to be a great sportsman. No. The Christian response, and I think most people would say the response is you love the child because of who they are. And even with those modifications, they're still not deterministic. You could give a child every athletically beneficial gene that there is, and the child could still have the mental decision to be a couch potato. And those genes, unless they're exercised and used to the greatest benefit, are of no use to them at all. And what happens to a child who may be given musical abilities, who says, I don't want to learn that, I'm not playing the piano, I went through that phase, and I've got no musical gifts at all. But imagine the parents' reaction. If now we've spent all that money on you, to give you that, and you're throwing it away. I've heard parents say that of children who go for private education and then trash all that. But imagine you've spent that sum of money to give them the gifts in their genome, and no, I can't be bothered.
Question here, Tina.
Oh, sorry.
Is that on right now? Yes. Thank you. I think you said that science is a gift from God to humankind, if I'm not mistaken. But I just noted that, for example, in the Bible, I think it's in Genesis, possibly chapter 9, there's an example of transgressive acts by entities in the non-physical realms, and arguably, possibly, maybe the book of 1st Enoch, which Jesus probably would have had access to, part of it indicates transgressive ways in which such beings gave technologies towards humankind. That may or may not be correct. And then going forward a bit in time, if one looks at the history of scientific development, it can be argued that there are quite strong elements of things like occultism, Kabbalah, and alchemy have influenced scientists, you know, very prominent scientists, including Isaac Newton, for example. And then going still ahead a bit further to, for instance, the Book of Revelation, there appear to be descriptions that may well be of a scientific and technological nature, such as the mark of the beast and image of the beast, which are in opposition to God, but are scientific.
Can we get to the question,
please? So the question is, to state that science is a gift from God to humankind, is that too simplistic a statement?
It is a very simplistic statement, but I still want to stand by it, partly because I think there is a difference between science, and this is a difference that politicians do not understand. There is a difference between science, which is discovering the way the world works, which is according to, if you like, the way that God has set the world up, and technology, which is saying, how can I use that science? And you can use things for good or for evil. Let's think of an example. So the telescope, you know, enables you to peer into the distance. Great thing to say, but it also enables you to be able to see your enemy sooner than them so that you can shoot them down. So the way in which we use the science is we can use it for good or for ill. But the basic science, when I say I think it's a gift from God, is God allows us to explore the way in which the world works. We don't live in a capricious universe. It's not based on random principles. No, we live in a universe that is investigatable. In fact, was it Einstein who said the most remarkable thing about the world is that I'm paraphrasing what he said, but we can actually, but we can observe it and measure it. Why does maths work? Why does science work? It's because that's in the nature of the world that we live in. It's not random. So that's why I would want to stand by that science itself is a gift from God who allows us to explore the way that our universe works. It allows us to explore what makes us human. But then what we do with that, I quite agree with you, is open to all sorts of misuse. And we've got to be very careful about the use of science as compared to the discoveries of science.
Was there a last question then?
Yes.
I think we'll make this the last. Given what you've just said, that you can use science for good or evil, isn't genetic modification of embryos inevitable? And then the real problem is making sure it's used for good and not for evil.
I don't know if it's inevitable or not. I think it probably is. I think, to be honest, even though there might be international moratoria on doing it, there's always the rogue scientist who does things because it's better to be wanted for murder than not to be wanted at all, some people say. Now, it is that the fame that goes with being the first person to do something, even though what you've done is bad. And that probably is one of the things that motivated that Chinese scientist. There would always be rogue nations. You could go to the country that's invested in that technology. You get sort of what might be called genetic modification tourism. So I think it probably inevitable it will happen. I think, just maybe to turn your question sideways slightly, if we say it's inevitable it will happen, what should our response be to those people who have been genetically modified? Do we treat them as freaks? Do we treat them as in some way very unusual? And I think we need to think in advance as Christians that say we might do all that we can to stop that happening. But if it does happen, those are people with personalities. They too are made in the image of God. And the fact that we modified their genome doesn't affect that. We treat them as fallen human beings, just like the rest of us. So I would want to make that quite clear. We're not generating species that we'll put on a pedestal. We're not generating, if you like, things that we might put as the equivalent of a zoo animal know, something to be, to entertain us. These are humans in the same way as you and I are.
Thank you very much, Keith. I think I'm right in saying, though, that one thing that is allowed now in the UK is what's sometimes called three-parent embryos with the mitochondrial DNA from a third. Yeah. That is actually allowed, isn't it? It's another subject, but it's the one area that was very controversial.
It is very controversial. I mean, I wouldn't call it three-parent babies.
No, nor would
it's,
I, but...
it's 2.0005, yeah, or whatever it might be. It is a different question, but that is now allowable under certain circumstances.
For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, we can discuss with us afterwards. But Keith, I do want to thank you very much indeed. You've enlightened us, challenged us. We've got a lot of thinking to do, but thank you very much indeed.